Oh, good. How excellent. And I wonder where Gerda's father came from. Yeah, but where was he born? Yeah, I know, but like, was that Germany or Poland? Yeah, I know, but he was born in 1902. Okay, so unfortunately you're siding with me. I was hoping. Because I do so much better when I'm fighting alone. He was? He really? I would have got that from him. Anyway, so, you know, it was an interesting time to have a father who was Polish and German, or German and Polish, whichever one of the sibs you were. To be born then. And I think Larry's timing was much better than mine. Like, missing that war and coming in when he actually started making money. That was good. No, but you understand what I'm saying in terms of the world news. You know, we had a washing machine that was a little bit classier by the time you were born. And there was this kind of quality of, when I was three, four, five, six, I really love you, dear. And then I had this one sister who needed a lot of attention at that time. She had a lot of physical difficulties and didn't think she should have. She tended to push the envelope a fair amount. And so often I was giving them to share with her. In case something happened to her during the night. And so there was an awareness of like not having much money and being criticized by the kids at school for the fact that I could have been a Nazi, and la-di-da-di-da-di-da, and no money. So I developed this amazingly excellent ability to not want to want. I'm so good at it, it's hard to believe when we began to get to the age of consciousness and watch for a good while, but I was very good at I don't want to want. And it was a childhood that. And then I went into adolescence and it changed my life. And then it hit again whenever circumstances came. When there was some choice I had to make that involved my pride. Immediately I didn't want to. So I was willing to be brave and sacrificial for the world because that meant I wasn't willing to be brave and sacrificial for myself. So it was only partially true because the inner and outer were not in part. That's true. Of course I really wanted, so I turned my want to not wanting. I left the passion, I changed the perception. I don't want to want. I want to not want. I got real good at just like cutting it off and go for what? Don't want to be, go for what? Go for what? I was fairly skilled at that. So then the whole world became seen in those eyes. Is that clear? We will make anything into an identity based on a childhood vow, and we'll even have forgotten when we make it up. It's like totally obscure. It just feels right. You all have your own story that's at least as dramatic as mine. Sure, I'm such a good speaker. You know, something in you is telling the best story you ever read. It's very personal. And if you keep running into the same kind of patterns over and over again, that's the "and they live happily ever after" result of the story. Because somehow that refuge to a child with such a vow is not the things that happen to you, it's how you freeze on them that makes the difference. We all have the same ability for the glory, for divine joy, for transcendence. The people that turn the energy in or don't see this as the great offer, who don't understand how to let go of the cherished self, get to learn as they go. Old age homes are very interesting. Or you can practice by looking at what your childhood vow is, and pretending you're pleased with it, that you're transcending it. Or see the screen behind which the movie is playing. Or watch the face between the box cars and that car. But certainly don't focus on how I get rid of that. There is something in that quality that is based on some kind of kindness, if you understand it. I have a friend who had colic for the first year and a half of his life. He was actually allergic to his mother's milk. He's down his chin raised. Didn't surprise me, he was suffering.
Was formed by suffering.
He is one of the most amazing men. I'm totally convinced that he's about to be burned. And teaching him to turn around and watch that sensation rather than act on it has been such an interesting play. It's an amazing man. So handsome, he's so profoundly, you know, generous, incredible heart. But there's this childhood vow, you know? I'm really wanting but not able to incorporate. So really loving, but his love causing him pain. We've gone into bit part plans here. Damn, he's good. He's very good. And watching him forget about that energy and understanding that he knows suffering and he knows the cessation. Watching him act on that and watching him as he walks around, that people are transformed into being interested in you. It's amazing. And he's just beginning to get close. So it's not by trying to change the vow. It's by seeing that that is there and seeing what qualities did come out of it. And then focusing on the space around it. Okay? So you get rid of your attitude of gonna fix it. There ain't nothing to fix. It's just a matter of learning to move. Simply a matter of learning. Nothing to it, really, just no big deal. Oh my God, time to go for a walk. Okay, shall we go for a walk? And I would like you to try to watch the passion and perception by when you're walking today. I would like you to go, we're going to do a half hour walk. Is that good? Mm-hmm. Come back here at 20 after 11. And when you're walking, I would like you to notice the gap, the sort of quality of like when you're interested in something and when you see it, and then what kind of meaning it has for you. Seeing a rose bush or seeing a log wall or hearing somebody yell, and what is the first scenario that comes through your mind? It's sort of called, I want you to go for a walk with your ignorance, with your power of ignorance. When you can see just one thing, it means you're ignoring a whole number of things, doesn't it? Ignorance is a power. Ignorance is what allows us not to get lost in the mists of possibilities. But if you notice when you ignore, just ordinarily, you ignore everything to see this, and then you ignore everything to see this, and then you ignore. Your ignorance keeps moving objects naturally. You know that. And so that you get an overall picture in a while of your environment, just automatically. But if you don't do that, if you keep looking at the same thing, like people do when they're artistic, or move certain ways, because that's like a way to hold the focus, you understand? Soothes the consciousness that's continuously overwhelmed by everything. They don't have a very good power of ignorance, so they teach themselves to hold to something. Nothing else works. Is that clear? But we have a very good power of ignorance. What I would like you to start to notice is what power of what the main motive for your, for one of your better, more powerfully developed ignorances is? Is it like fear? Is it greed? Is it, you know, altruism? Is it looking for a new carpet? Is it? What are you looking at, and what do you find yourself keeping looking for? Why will I walk down this street, or why will I walk down that street? Is that clear? Want me to say more about that? You got it. Do you know what I mean by ignorance? Okay, so because perception depends on ignoring everything else and just seeing this little part of the possibilities, then I want you to start to be clear about why, when you're looking at a street, you tend to see this, and maybe the person beside you will see that. You know that sometimes you walk down the street with somebody and they see totally different things than you. And so, what is the passion that is driving you to see this, or what is that better? And when I don't want you to change any of that. I just want you to be clear about seeing it. Shift from just this action to the whole awareness of the mode of driving the action, driving the perception of both the passion and the perception without negating them. There is nothing that you need to change. You only need to change your clinging. And the clinging is best changed by just clearly seeing how we work. Because when you do that, you fall apart. Then, of course, you can love. Wow. Is that good? Okay, meet you back here in, okay, we got now 25 minutes. Go. first animal and medium it. Rolls. And once you unroll it, you can roll it and let go. What does it do? It rolls it. That's what it does. Habitual mind is like a scroll of paper. So you unroll it from its habits, and the minute you let go, it rolls up again. So, like, it isn't a matter of whether it happened once. It's a matter of it happened once. Or it doesn't roll. Once you unroll it, it rolls up again. Immediately curls back up. You need to continually flatten it out eventually, okay? Because that's a habit then too. Now you got two habits to choose from. Sometimes it's good to roll it up. Sometimes it's good to flatten it. It's like giving yourself options. That's important. That's called freedom. Not making yourself good, which is not called freedom. Because then you can't be bad. And there's a use for bad. Isn't there? Yeah. So why would you like to have yourself off? Before you. It's not your view of enlightenment. It's your known view. I think I probably whipped that one to death, have I? Isn't that a beautiful quote? Our constant challenge as practitioners, the true focus of our practice, is reducing the attachment we have in the core of our mind. Not in our habits, but in our clinging to the right answer. Our clinging to an identity or... That makes sense? I don't know. It's so beautiful. I think this is so beautiful. Because it's the haunted domain of the mind. And he has another really good picture about passion and perception, which I think is just gorgeous. Did you see that? You know? On here, like more like Yamantaka than the 64 hands. And so reducing the attachment in the core of your mind means quit being obsessed with the attachment. Quit being obsessed with whether you're attached or not, or it only happened once. Or... You understand? Quit being reduced to the attachment of, like, if it's true, well, finally I got a real insight, but it couldn't have been very good because it didn't last. You know, instant gratification is our biggest addiction. We don't have any kind of joy in learning something for the first time, however many times we do. We are so caught up in performance that we don't let ourselves be children. Isn't that true? Well, I thought I knew that already, you know. I've heard every one of you and me say that how many times? God, I should have learned. Why didn't I remember that from last time? Well, because this mind is like a scroll, you know. You unroll it, and then it rolls back up again. And it takes a while. Well, absolutely not. Absolutely so. That's absolutely true. Relatively, however, there is continuously an eye arising in each circumstance, like that, or like this. So relatively is where the problem is. Absolutely, there's no problem. To the time that is effect. When we expect cause and effect to make us safe. Okay? Instant gratification. I'm really happy to change as long as I don't have to change. Please teach me to meditate, but I'd like nothing new to happen. Why don't you understand me? As the some kind of childhood doubt. And to keep sitting because you wonder who else is there besides that one. And always you get to a certain plateau in your practice and there's a sense of resistance before you can go to the next step. So there are all those different ones. It takes a long time to understand the power of inner observation. Looking at the observer rather than being the observer. It takes a long time to understand the power of that, what that does. How that changes your perception to something much more gentle. To greater joy. And because we so much love to do the right thing, we're so scared of the same thing. Yeah. And my greatest success in terms of teaching people how to meditate is when people actually say to me, like the last five people who have done retreats and meet up there. You know, when you would talk about how much you love meditating, I just kind of thought you were weird. But next year, could I do a 3-month retreat? Or a 6-month retreat? I'd say, you can do whatever you want. Oh, you mean here? Hey, I'm doing a 6-month this winter. I mean, moving in here? Oh, well, I don't know. Maybe I'll check my schedule later. Because the point is to actually start being interested in what is perception. In the really joyful question. And then go and what? Well, what is it that is really the strongest desire in your being? Well, what would be the strongest desire in this? Then you're actually interested in other people. You're not putting your views and beliefs. You're putting in your interest, which is like where first interest. That's what I'm calling first, is basic interest. Interest is one of the 7 factors of enlightenment, one of the 7 mental factors that needs to be present before you can have an experience. We all know that. But to actually practice it, by recalling you know what it is. What an interesting idea. That's a rising yoga, isn't it? Whatever you use, whatever passion you use, using a passion, isn't that what a rising yoga is? Isn't that what, you know, every one of the arising yogas, they start with some way. I'm doing for the practice of, I'm doing this practice so that I come to understand that compassion is not separate from the activity that stirs the depth of samsara. That's what I want. That's my interest. Every one of the arising yogas is good. Meditations in the Tibetan tradition and in all the traditions always starts by naming what you want. Always starts by naming what you want. Every preparation for meditation always includes getting your emotions lined up with an aspect of transcendence. Always does. Always does. Otherwise, how can you pray? If you don't have meaning behind it, how can you pray? Can you? When do you really pray? When you really care, or you really don't give a damn? When?
I'm desperate.
So now, encourage that sense of great, strong desire in more times than just when you're desperate. Because that means the rest of the time you're depending on yourself. But you know yourself isn't going to last. I don't care how old your father is. I fell downstairs. Me! I'm so aware. Just last week, my finger bent right over. My finger. Doesn't it know it's not supposed to be there? It was just a little gap in the world. It wasn't real, you understand. Or, oh, how awful. I fell downstairs. I can't tell you the fear I had. I'm putting up railings. And I'm going to get a special stair path. And I need 15 people to do research for me. Right? What are the three conceits? And what's the last one? Oh, no. I want to hear. All recently off the rack of this one. What are the three conceits? What, you don't remember yesterday?
I remember the feeling of it.
Well, so give the feeling some words. Don't be right. Do you remember the feeling of this?
Yeah.
Okay, start there.
Well, that felt nice.
Yes, it did. Okay, so what are the three conceits? What did you name them rather than conceit?
Delusion.
I thought you named them pride. Did you?
Yeah.
Watch your mind right now. What is your mind doing? Yeah, which is what? It's like a kind of pride, isn't it? I am supposed to be this one. Isn't it?
Yeah.
Right, it's a kind of pride. And there are no right answers, so now what? If there are no right answers, now what?
I think
it. Yeah, so rather than responding with I, remember the feeling down your back. You're too fast. Remember the feeling. Actually remember. Where were your hands? And what was the feeling of your in your hands? And what was the feeling on the back? And how did that affect the way your energy felt in your body? Right. And with that bringing it down, then what was your attitude about pride? That's right. And so then when we were talking about it further, for a while you understood it. Do you remember that? For a while. Linda was saying something. What was she talking about? Now you watch how your mind starts filling in. You see how your identity of who you should be freezes your intelligence if you can't get the right answer. Do you see it?
I just feel like numb.
That's right. If you can't get the right answer, you're numb, you're frozen. So, but if you go to a physical experience of the coolness on your back, the warmth in your hands, that helps you unnumb. So you use that in your memory rather than focusing on the numbness, you go back to the feeling. So focus on the back again. What was that feeling? What did I just say? Watch what occurring. She went away, I had to ask her if she was here. Watch what occurring. Were you in the tape recording? Don't you dare! Do you want to know how many people are beginning to suddenly understand something here? And they know pretty well most of the people in this room, except Leslie and you, obviously. No. Do you hear me? What am I saying? Whatever. It's part of the whole. We're all doing the same thing. Nobody is separate from anybody else. Is anybody separate from anybody else? Some people would like to think that it doesn't go along with their interests, so they're half tuned out. But it's not true. This is the most profound interest you have. When am I caught in conceit, and when am I not? When you're caught in conceit, you're taking refuge in yourself. But unfortunately, you're taking refuge in something that's impermanent, subject to dissatisfactoriness, and without a fixed identity. So the bottom line is, it ain't refuge. There are only three types of being caught in that. And one is what? What did she say about the Mercedes? No. What did she say about the Mercedes? Better than? Now, isn't that interesting? Because you do know it. Because you were here. But one perception, one mind, doesn't know it. But you dare. One perception doesn't know it because it's not sure it's going to have the right answer. Okay? So, one perception does know it because it doesn't have to have the right answer. It just has to remember what happened yesterday. And it's not that you can't do it. It's the fear of coming up with the right answer. Is that pretty straightforward? So when you can see that as a habitual perception, then when it comes up in you, you can actually have compassion rather than just getting into, you know, the stocks and putting yourself in the main square. I mean, unless you really like those wooden stocks, you know, where your head goes through and standing in the square. Unless it's like there's some kind of superior pleasure you get out of it and you're not done doing that yet. But you don't have to be caught in suffering. You don't have to be caught in confusion. Confusion is fine. Being caught in it sucks. Being superior is fine. Believing it sucks. Being inferior is fine. Believing it sucks. You understand? All those things rise and fall, and it's all just part of the river. Sometimes it's muddy, sometimes... But you're not a fixed identity. So every time, you know, somebody says to me, but you don't understand, I'm not like that. Another card? Because I am like everything. And so are you. You know, I'm sorry, we're all extremely special. Damn. Well, just damn. Ah, how you have suffered. Ah, how I have suffered. Ah, how he has suffered. Ah, how she has suffered. It ain't a competition. Is that clear? We all have to line up and say, regardless of the circumstances or how I build my story, what is refuge? So it's not me looking at somebody else and wondering if I'm getting the right answer. Is it me watching that part of myself that wants to get a right answer and say, oh, that definitely needs a better refuge? Is there one? It's like having clarity. The difference between being frozen in one mind's fit. And having the clarity, like, oh, here I am, frozen in one mind state. I think I'll turn my head. Is that clear? Oh, this is where I like to get frozen. Oh, I think I'll turn my head. Your muscles, your neck. It's not a matter of whether you're caught. How do you get the goose out of the bottle? How do you do it? Without killing the goose or breaking the bottle. How do you do it? What's the answer?
There
it is. There, it's up. There is no permanent state. Well, damn. Now you tell me, just when I built my house, got all the books in it I could ever want, and I'm planning to read them. What do you mean it's on fire? You should see my poetry collection. What? You don't think it's going to last? How dare you? Okay. I got 10 minutes for the next paragraph. So we've done the first two, right? We've done invoke the best frame of mind for the practice of meditation, recall the root gurus and experience their blessings. This makes the mind, body, and the place of meditation divine and pure. Isn't that lovely? Isn't that lovely? Just that pure understanding that whatever is here is a flow, is radiant. That's what divine means, radiant. Radiant. That's the meaning of the word radiant. That's its root. Radiant. It's also the root of devil, by the way. Devi. Curious or incurious. From Sanskrit, by the way. Recall the root gurus and experience their blessings. This makes the mind body in the place of meditation divine. Exactly. Because you're recalling the joy of not knowing because of about to see something new, not the pain of not being able to hold on to what you think. There's a big difference between the two. Thinking you should know something. And not having the joy of about to know something. Very big difference, huh? Neat, huh? Acknowledge the clarity of mind, because then that gives you clarity, doesn't it? You're not drowning. You're thinking, oh, I don't know that. I wonder. your mind opens. Okay? Then you're the lightning flash in the water of all possibility. Aren't you? That beauty of that moment of clear, in time and space, in the boundless possibilities of all existence. Where the temporal and the eternal are non-dual. The lightning flash into the water of all possibilities. That's what people call it, the cross. Where time and space intersect. The transcendence of duality. Where the center is neither time nor space, nor not time, nor not space. Acknowledge the clarity of mind known as awareness. Realize the good fortune bestowed by this world. I do love that. Who wrote this? Oh, for goodness sake. I'm glad I did something in it. Last Christmas. Briefly reflect on the pain of all states of existence. Beings who live in very profound God realms, when they start losing those God realms, it is, says the Tibetan tradition, as painful as a fish jerked out of water by a hook and then thrown on hot sand. First of all, the shock of pain in an environment that is always, everywhere, joyful and satisfying. Jerked out of that with a hook, with absolutely no control, totally hopeless, and then thrown onto hot sand. Like so many people who are in a disaster who aren't used to it. Or have a different idea of what they're like. Where one of your ideals fails and you think you're safe, you think you're one of the chosen, one of the few. And then because it was an ideal, an identity, it dissolves because of circumstances. And you feel like everything in you has been betrayed, that it was all a trick. Understand me? And you go to bitterness. You don't go, oh good, now I know what refuge is. You don't do that. You go to, oh, it's just, I don't want to live. Or whatever. It's called the God realm. Reflect on the pain of all states of existence. Is when you have so much identified with a certain position that when it shifts or you learn something else, you just close down. And this enormous fear. I've met or known people from every religious practice who have based their belief on something being true, and then they had an experience that caused them to feel it wasn't true. And, you know, I know certainly many of Buddhists who, because their teacher did do this or didn't do that, they lost, you know, they wanted to get another wonk or another teaching because they had done all the work of all the other ones. And their teacher would say to them, well, you received all the wonkers you need, now go meditate. But what should I meditate on? You should meditate on your own question. You're not a good teacher, you're not telling me what to do. And then I am a believer because it makes me safe. I can go around and tell everybody else the right answer. The idea comes down and doesn't work. Damn. Oh, well, do I get a refund? Oh, yeah, the refund is that I should know what doesn't work?
You must be joking. It's a trick.
Con artist. I'm going to go and join Scientology. That's... Oh, sorry. I'm going to go and be a Mooney. Okay. I'm going to go and be, what, you know, whatever. Jewish, Christian, Islam, you know, whatever. Right? An atheist, whatever. Unitarian. I should have said Unitarian. It's really interesting getting talks at a Unitarian church. People really love the theory, but yes, and come and meditate. And so like 40 people will come to the class of theory, and 3 will come to the class of meditation. Well, we like the idea. Beautiful, beautiful discussions. Could you actually sit down and do it? Well, I'm not sure yet. I don't want to get caught. Quite beautiful, really. Feel sadness for those who are blindly caught in unhappiness. Blindly caught. Do you understand what I'm talking about here? In unhappiness. No clarity. Unable to see how they become trapped by their own habitual like and dislike. Aversion, attraction, and ignorance, and lack of awareness. If you only focus on those things, on finding what you like and what you dislike, and finding what you dislike and what you like, just for the heaven of it, and then every once in a while noticing what you habitually ignore, it's incredible. It's going to open up the doors of perception. And now you can do that without a shrine room. You can do that walking around in the office. It's not a big issue. But you have to actually do it. Okay, 12, so I'm just gonna... So, from the pity that arises when seeing this way, when you see how we are all habituated, not only you, when you're habituated, and I go, gee, 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 out of you, because I think you care. But all the people that are habituated who don't care, who don't want to know, who will cling desperately. And all the people who care but feel like they don't deserve. And all the people who care but can't find anybody to hear them. And all the animals and all the angels and all the elementals. All the beings that care. That the pity that arises when seeing all the beings who are trapped by their own habitual aversion, attraction, and ignorance, then obviously a sense of compassion, a sense of wanting to be, give them the space to be with them in a spacious enough way so they don't get caught in being pressed into the habitual. But actually have a little space to see them, which is called a compassionate wish to benefit all beings by this practice. That means I am doing this practice so that I learn how to have the space to see in my own being in a way that will be useful to others. Pretty straightforward, isn't it? So we have here like 3 absolutely essential setups for a really good meditation. Invoking the idea of between the known and unknown. Invoking the idea, the understanding that it is the clarity of mind that lets you choose a mind state rather than be trapped in a mind state. And that we all have that clarity. Even if we're clear about being confused, it's still clarity. Okay? And that there are no extra brownie points for knowing or not knowing. They're both just stances. Okay? And then the realization of understanding what a gift that is and wanting to practice not only for oneself but for the benefit of others. Because we will do for others what we can do for ourselves. And that's another one of those topics. Okay, any last minute questions, answers, comments, and complaints for this morning? All the three levels. Mm-hmm. Basically, in the Buddhist tradition, they say that we have all beings have three levels of manifesting or of consciousness. One is called body or form. One is called speech, sometimes voice. And one is called mind. The form level has six senses. Six senses. What's that, Larry? Oh my gosh! Yeah, you can get that book from Bodhi Publishing, can't you? No, in Kinmount, isn't it? And the address is there. I think you could probably tell you, probably let you look at it. I wrote that book for the thesis with my beloved teacher. It's just recently being reprinted, and a lot of people have been asking for it to be reprinted, and a lot of people who are new to the teaching have been reading it and really finding it useful, which is, you know, I mean, the joy of that, to have like actually represented my beloved teacher well enough. With all my, of course, being the ultimate power of being able to add footnotes to your teacher. She was a cab driver too, and a pasty maker. She had many careers before she ended in Cooper. Anyway. So body, speech, and mind. The body has six sense doors. The five senses plus mind. And so therefore is sort of the densest type of consciousness. And the number one thing that it's like clay or like a riverbed because it's formed by activity. And the activity is always changing, and so the clay is always changing, or the riverbed is always changing. So it's, although moving the slowest, because it's the densest, it's always showing the results of past action. Mm-hmm. I like to think of it as like watching through a rearview mirror. So you're driving somewhere, you're being somewhere, you're motivated somewhere, and in looking at what is in around you is shows you the result of past action. The number one quality of the body is loving kindness and compassion. To treat them with loving kindness, the body with loving kindness and compassion. Because its results are, it is result from the past. It is not the cause. How you react to it is the speech body, which is the sculptor, or the shape of the flow, or the power of the flow, or the intent of the flow of the river. And it has six sense doors. We have a lot of representation of that in the season about to come out called Christmas. Because we have all those Christmas cards with angels who have those wings, right? Mm-hmm. To represent their fluttering energy movement. Its speech body is more refined energy than the body body. And they play harps and they have halos, right? And the two senses that are present in the speech body are sight and sound, light and vibration, sound, and mind. So it is the body of intent, the body of that communicates, the flow between the hyphen between nama and rupa, the flow of intention, outer and inner, between each other and the communicating body. The communing body. And as I said the other day, it extends 3,500 miles. If you know how to measure it. And you have the right equipment to measure it. Of course. I'm waiting for someone to verify it, but I haven't met anybody yet. That I would believe. The mind body has one sense door. Oh yeah, the body body operates in past, present, and future. The speech operates in a kind of a global time, in relationship, so the globe of meaning. Or is that good? Yeah, it's time. They're all experiential, though. From a Buddhist point of view, they're all experiential. It's the quality of self that's questionable. The speech body has quite different qualities of self than the body body, because it can be just an awareness of sight and sound of, you know, like jhana, or like kundalini, or whatever you want to call it, like bliss, you know, a sense of holiness, or, you know, all of those, all the way to a sense of you know, like being like an almost like in touch with the elementals and qualities like that, but being aware, you know, what is this? This is a good space. This is a bad space. You know. Yeah, I could feel. You know, I could feel what you were doing. Oh, you're thinking about a tape recorder, aren't you? No, I'm not saying that. When I said that to you, notice your desire for a right answer. When I said that to you, it wasn't because I knew what you thought. It was because I could feel your mind splitting.
Right.
The energy, the speech body. We can all feel everybody else's speech body. Is that true? Mm-hmm. So that's why the speech body is like much more likely to be the one where you'll understand how to become a lover. Because you can feel the other person's fear and hope. But the problem is that usually when you feel another person's fear, you immediately go into your fear defenses. So when somebody is present who knows how to meet their own defenses, when they're with somebody who is caught in defenses, they're not so moved by it. So people think of you as kind even if you're a total bitch. Because you're open to their fear of meeting with a total bitch. Does that make sense? And you don't have anything to gain by it. Is that clear? I hope that's clear. So the speech body is working on the present energy that is the creative energy in form and out of form. It's like moving from point to point and from point to point. It's the relationship. It's the meaning. And the mind body is boundless, it's without. It's without any particular, it is without measurement. It's vast. Hard to find a word, is it? It's big, eh? Like, yeah, it's like real big. It's big, yeah. And it can never be felt. What I was saying about mind, you notice you've never been able to actually fill your mind. You've been able to continuously return to one place that you've called a pocket because you've decided to make it look like that. A pocket or a stage. There are certain ways we use our mind as if it were finite. We create ignorance in order to keep ourselves entertained. But the mind-body is the one it is. It's got two qualities to it. The qualities are clarity, what we're talking about here, being able to see the dance of cause and effect, and emptiness, being aware of the verbness of all things, not nouns, that verbs, that play of them, call it here. Two qualities of the mind body, clarity and emptiness. So the work of awakening is to understand the body-body as the body-body and not use the body-body as the speech body. You know, by like trying to change it through motor, like kicking the door because it's locked. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Using the body-body as the body-body, using the speech-body as the speech-body, and using the mind-body as the mind-body, when you accept all three as they are, and that creates a fourth body.